This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.
Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Everybody, welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. The markets piece is financial markets, which is a big part of the conversations we have here. The financial markets are maddening at times, hence the madness. And there's other aspects of madness in the conversations that we have on Twitter around what's going on in the financial markets. And the milkshakes piece has to do with the dollar milkshake theory, which my friend here, Brent Johnson, came up with to describe the financial system. You can learn more about all of that and more about our show on milkshakespod.com. But we're going to jump right into it. We have been doing two a week, Brent, but you're doing a bit of traveling. Currently, you are in Zurich. Is that correct?
Yeah, I got here earlier today. And, you know, it's funny. I love Zurich. A lot of times people will say that Switzerland is kind of a very beautiful but boring place. And there is some truth to that. But I love walking around both Geneva and Zurich. And every time I'm walking through Zurich, I always feel like I'm like walking through like a novel or something. Whether it's a spy novel or some gothic novel, you know, the little cobblestone streets and the flags and the churches. And I don't know, it's just, I've always found it to be a pretty cool place.
Well, look, this is interesting because when you reference spy movies, I think James Bond and there's something so funny about those stories because they really are so ridiculous. Like the amount of bullet dodging, right? And the ability to kind of see in those movies, James Bond truly is playing 4D chess. So let me use that as a springboard to kind of go into this conversation of what we've seen since even last week. Number one, let's just get the topic out there and have the conversation about what's been going on with the dollar and the rhetoric around it being the end of the dollar and all that type of stuff. And more importantly than just kind of rehashing what, you know, you believe or what you think is going to happen, maybe you can shine some light onto why we're seeing some of the pullback and dispel the narrative, but maybe in a more macro sense, explain what's going on. And then I'll bring us back to this whole spy theory that I was just hinting at.
Sure, sure. Well, I think, you know, I will say the rhetoric around the upcoming and inevitable death of the dollar over the last, let's call it 10 to 12 days, has really been incredible. I have to say I've never really seen anything like it. And it's not so much the story. It's a very big story, and it likely should get attention. That's not the surprising part to me. And I probably shouldn't be surprised by the surprising part, but the surprising part to me is the willingness for people to just automatically believe the headline without doing any additional thinking or consideration about it. You know, there is no doubt that the world is trying to de-dollarize. It has been tried many, many times, and it will continue to be tried. But and there will be some progress made. So I'm not blind to it. I'm not ignoring it, and I don't have blinders on regarding it. But the difference between a headline and an actuality are two very big different things. And I'll give you a very good example. Back in 2019, there was a headline, and it came out that China and Saudi Arabia were going to now trade in-kind oil and for services. So in other words, China was going to get oil from Saudi Arabia. I'm sorry, this was Iraq. Sorry, it was Iraq. And in return, it wasn't going to be in dollars. And in return, China was going to provide infrastructure services and, you know, all kinds of, you know, construction and different types of in-kind services to help them out. And many times over the last couple of years, people would reference this as, you know, they're no longer trading in dollars. Well, the fact is that deal that was announced accounted for like less than 10% of the overall trade between the two. So, and it didn't include oil. It was other services. It was other imports and exports, not oil. And it never actually took place. It never actually got implemented. It was announced, and it was heralded as like this big change in the global order, but nothing ever actually happened. Now, if we bring that back to what's going on today, I'm not saying that these things won't happen. I'm not saying that they can't happen. I'm just saying it's very early to already, accept it as like, it's like a fait accompli that the dollar is over and that we can have this new BRICS currency or multipolar, world. But there is no doubt that it has hit a fever pitch over the last 10 days. It is really quite something to see.
Yeah, I don't care what the topic is, what the situation is, it's once you have the pendulum swing so far one direction, I kind of enjoy the fact that now people are starting to look at this signal as almost like a bottom,
right?
Because it's gotten so ridiculous but what would be the... In your eyes, because this is a complex system, and I think this is one of the things that kind of irks me a little bit when people want to throw one really silly chart up with a couple basic technicals and think they can predict the future. But from a fundamental standpoint, what would your case be for some of the weakness if you scrap the narrative completely?
Sure. So a lot of times, these big macro moves are very confusing and a little bit hard to understand, especially this is the case, even if you do work in the industry, and it's especially so if you're not kind of versed in, finance or macroeconomic indicators or just in the industry in general. But the reality is that the move in the dollar, just currencies in general and markets in general, are actually fairly straightforward. If we just look at the last let's call it 12 to 18 months. When the U.S. started indicating that they were going to raise rates and then started actually raising rates, that created a very large interest rate differential and the expectation for an even larger interest rate differential between the United States dollar and its peer currencies. And if you get paid more to sit in dollars than you get paid to sit in another currency, that's going to make the dollar more attractive. Same vice versa, right? If you could get 5% by sitting in a euro treasury and you're only getting, 1% to sit in the US treasury, that extra 4% makes a big difference, all else being equal. And so as the US dollar as the US rates started to go higher, it made the US dollar more attractive. And as the dollar gets stronger versus other currencies, because there's so much US dollar debt in the world, the dollar going higher is almost like an interest rate hike on the rest of the world because the dollar is used so much for global commerce. So as the US was raising rates last year, it was making the dollar stronger. It was slowing down the global economy. And it kind of became this self-reinforcing cycle. That went all the way through September. And I know we've talked about this before, but by the end of September, much of the world was either in crisis or very close to crisis. China had to, they weren't doing QE, but they had to loosen monetary conditions tremendously and do a number of different moves in order to help bail out the real estate market there. Japan had to intervene in both their sovereign debt and their currency market because it was in crisis. The Bank of England had to intervene in the gilts market because it was blowing up. And the European Central Bank, even though they had finally raised rates after 10 or 12 years, they had also had to set up a special facility to buy periphery country bonds because yields were spiking there. And so, and at the time, the U.S. was still raising rates. So it was creating kind of this chaotic scenario. Now, right about that same time, let's say now we're in late September, early October. Around the same time, we're starting to get up near the debt ceiling. And this is important to understand. So at the same time that we are getting up near the debt ceiling, what that means is that the Treasury can no longer sell bonds to the public. Now, what that also means is they're not going to be getting any cash back into the treasury from the public. Okay. So the United States bank account is not going to be increasing. It's going to be flat unless they spend more money, in which case that bank account is going to fall down and that cash is going to get sent out into the market. So that started to take place, let's call it October, November, right at the same time where Powell came out and said, our job is not done yet. We are going to continue to raise rates, but it's going to be data dependent, and we have made a lot of progress. So he indicated that the pace of rate hikes was probably going to slow, even though rate hikes would continue. Okay, so we already talked about how rate hike differentials make a big difference, but also the anticipation or the expectations of future rate hikes also has a huge impact on currencies. So as the pace of rate hikes was expected to slow, at the same time that the Treasury was sending cash out into the market while not also draining cash from the market, provided relief, however you want to call this, like that, it provided more liquidity to the market than had been there a few months later. And as a result of that, and the involvement of the other central banks around the world, has pushed the dollar back down, and it has helped those economies rise. And as the dollar falls, remember how I said earlier, as the dollar rising, it's almost like a rate hike on the rest of the world. The dollar falling is almost like a rate cut on the rest of the world. So it has given their economies a little more room to breathe, a little bit more room to grow. And as a result, we've seen an increase in global liquidity, right? And as there's general increase in global liquidity, the dollar should fall. And as there's a general decrease in global liquidity, the dollar will rise. And that's largely what has happened over the last 6 months. So again, I think sometimes there's these theories that, you know, there's a secret coordination by central banks behind the scenes, and there's all this, you know, shenanigans that are going on. And that absolutely does happen at certain times. But I really think over the last year, it's all pretty simple. I don't think there's some big, you know, secret going on that the central banks have colluded to push the dollar higher and now push the dollar lower. To me, it's all very much explained by market forces.
Awesome. That was what I was looking for, a little bit more of a what the flows are suggesting as a potential catalyst for the move up and down in the dollar. Now, the liquidity thing is interesting because I tell people who aren't obsessing in financial markets or paying attention on a regular basis, I try to explain some of these things that are going on, and the idea that oftentimes, you know, markets are moving on expectations. But when it comes to some of these potential crisis environments or crisis situations or black swan events, for example, when talking about, let's say, the banking crisis, you know, now all eyes tend to be on the fact that, okay, we had a relatively flat or solid, we had a decent employment number on Friday. So the Fed still has clearance to give another bump. Maybe they'll raise 25 bips. So you kind of have that type of pressure that we've been highlighting as the potential cause for the outflows. It seems pretty obvious that that's what it is, with all the depositor outflows going into money market funds and treasuries or government bonds of some kind. But now you're also kind of having this situation or focus around commercial real estate. So the point I'm really making is it's always the thing that you're not prepared for, you're not waiting for, that really catches you off guard. And so my point is like, if everyone's now watching commercial real estate, and we certainly empathize with the idea that the Fed is stupid and these central bankers don't know what they're doing, but they're not so stupid that they can't see the fact that commercial real estate is potentially an issue, because those assets are valued off of cash flow. There's now huge vacancies. If they're going to do a refinance because their loans are coming due, it's at much higher interest rates. That kills cash flow. Like, they get it. They can see that happening. So potentially one of the things that people aren't really paying attention to, because it's kind of been pushed in the back pages of the headlines, is this debt ceiling thing. And there's other research, there's research companies out there that have been doing some really interesting, pointing out some very interesting things around liquidity, and that liquidity is ticked up. And that liquidity kick up is potentially the sign that we have had a bottom, because after some form of crisis, you see government policy response, et cetera, that improves liquidity. But we haven't really seen any significant government response, unless you consider the BTFP, the Bank Term Funding Program, as significant enough to generate liquidity. But it seems to me that this debt ceiling circumstance, where we're not issuing new bonds and we're spending out of the Treasury coffers, adding liquidity into the market, is an interesting one to watch. Because in your opinion, what do you think then ends up happening once the debt ceiling is raised in terms of this whole macro environment of the dollar and everything else that's going on?
Well, I think once the debt ceiling is raised, the government wants to spend money. And as soon as the TGA is gone, they can't spend anymore. So as soon as they can start selling more bonds, and they're still, despite all the, you know, I don't know, memes to the contrary, there is still incredible demand for U.S. Treasury bonds. And as soon as the debt ceiling is lifted, I have no doubt that Yellen will be out there selling bonds like never before, and refilling the TGA. And you got to understand, when they're selling bonds, they're pulling money out of the market and putting it back into the government's coffers. Now, the government turns around and spends that pretty quickly back in, but there is a short-term flow of funds leaving the market and coming back into the Treasury's account. So they would be draining liquidity at the same time that they're spending, whereas right now they're just spending. So I think that would, and if that's also being done at the same time that Powell is still raising, that would definitely be a negative for liquidity. But it's possible, and again, we'll just have to wait and see, it's possible that by the time the debt ceiling is raised, that Powell is no longer raising, and he might even be just pausing or even thinking about cutting. And so if the Treasury is now draining liquidity while interest rate expectations are falling, perhaps there is still net liquidity. Again, there's all these different moving forces, so it's really hard to say. But what I think what makes it a little different this time, and I always say this, it's never different this time, but the one of the factors that's different this time is over the last, call it 10 or 15 years, whenever these issues have come up, it's typically been in a fairly, a very low inflation environment. Now we have these higher inflation pressures. It makes it much harder politically for the central bank, the Treasury, the government in general, to go back to an easy money policy. And here's where it gets really interesting for me, because now we're only about a year and a half away from the next presidential election. Typically, in the presidential election year, the government is going to want low interest rates. They want the stock market to be booming. So in that scenario, you would think that they would want to, maybe they want to go back to QE, maybe, you know, pump the markets up. The problem, though, is if they do that, it could also send inflation skyrocketing back higher. And inflation was one of the big problems that not necessarily Biden, because he wasn't being elected at this last election cycle, but it was a huge issue for the Democrats and the senators and the congressmen. And so it'll be really interesting now, whereas typically you would want to be pumping the markets up going into a presidential election, if inflation is still high, and maybe it won't be, but if it is, it would make it harder for them, I think, to go back to easy money policy leading up to the election.
Well, I mean, I'm no fan of Biden and liberal politics, but if the election was today, I think he's standing on solid enough ground. I mean, when you look at inflation's coming down, employment isn't really suffering massively yet, at least as far as what we would take from the NFP. So it's going to be an interesting 12 months if they're able to continue to subdue inflation and you don't have any massive crisis. And again, this liquidity issue in the banks is something that needs to, you know, you need to continue monitoring it and waiting to see if it gets worse. But, you know, as you like to say, they've been able to keep all these plates spinning.
Yeah, you know, I tweeted out, I was at the airport today and I was just kind of wasting some time. And I tweeted out, a meme about, for years, I've been hearing that the Fed is out of bullets, the central banks are out of bullets. and that there's nothing more they can do, but yet they continue to do it and the plates just keep spinning, right? And so I think anybody who says this is the end, it has to finish now, there's no possible way that they can, you know, keep this going, I can promise you they were, I remember people were saying the same thing 15 years ago. They were saying the same thing 10 years ago. They were saying the same thing 5 years ago. They said the same thing in 2020 after COVID. And now they're saying it again. So just, you know, this whole, and we've talked about this before, the certainty that this is it, right? You got to kind of put that to the side. It's okay to have conviction and it's okay to believe that, you know, we're nearing the end of this cycle, however you want to say that. And I would tend to agree with that. But I'm not certain about it, and I don't think anybody else should be certain about it either.
Yeah, you've really emphasized, and we got a lot of positive comments about your inevitable is not imminent. Likewise, I think right now with the hype around this is it, it's coming to an end. It's not that. Again, we don't have a chip on our shoulder when we're talking about these things. It's just more kind of like take a few steps back from the ledge, and that it's good to have conviction, but don't confuse conviction with certainty. And, you know, if you're so certain, chances are you're going to be surprised and you're going to get hurt, because things tend to unravel in very unexpected ways. That's why we're all in this game, because it's such a constant shit show. So, you know, when talking about the various things that's going on, whether it's Fed policy, this debt ceiling issue, overall, just the narrative around, you know, the dollar's days are numbered. One of the things that we also talk about too is one of the core concepts of the dollar milkshake theory is that a stronger dollar is what actually breaks the system, is what is really where the dollar eventually dies. And all of the people that are making these policy decisions from the ivory tower, they don't want to see this thing blow up. They're the greatest beneficiaries of the financial system as it exists. So the idea that they're just blindly driving the truck into the wall because they want some sort of great reset, to me at least, seems ludicrous. They already have it so good. Now I get sociopaths make some very interesting decisions. And what's another billion when you're already a sociopathic billionaire? But one of the things that I want to throw back to you on this topic, when people are getting really worked up about the dollar and these somewhat rumored alliances, if it's really the stronger dollar that breaks the back, like you were just describing, stronger dollars like a rate hike to the rest of the world. Well, if we continue seeing the dollar weaken or stay weak, do you feel like potentially, obviously, it allows everybody to kick the can further down the road, but do you think some of the talk around these alliances is because the dollar is crippling their economy, or is it because the U.S. is weaponizing the dollar geopolitically? If they're not getting crushed financially because the dollar is weaker, do you think they back off on some of this rhetoric because geopolitically they're not as motivated?
I think there's a little bit of truth to both of that. I think that part of the reason that it is bumped up as much as it has is I do think that, you know, last year it just showed how, I mean, the U.S. really, whether you like it or not, you know, put that aside. The fact is the U.S. has a kill switch on the global economy. All they got to do is jack rates and the whole thing comes down, right? And so I think what other countries have always known this, but when it's really put that blatantly to them, they've got to start to search for other alternatives. And so this goes back to what I was talking about. I'm not blind to this. I understand that people are trying to search, but if leaving the US dollar system, if all it took to leave the US dollar system was a certain level of anger and frustration, they would have left decades ago. It's very, very hard because it's also intertwined. But I think to your point, I think if the dollar does back off, my guess, and I would bet that the rest of the world will not use that dollar weakness to pay off their dollar debt. I bet they will issue more dollar debt than they ever have before, because that they get a cheaper rate when they do that. And that's what they've always done. And I don't think it's different this time. Now, if the rest of the, and here's the big part of it that I think a lot of people miss. The rest of the world owes just as much in US dollars as the US owes in US dollars. The difference is the U.S. can print the dollars to pay and service that debt. The rest of the world cannot print the dollars to pay that debt. So then people will tell me, well, what if they just default on that debt? Okay, if they default on that debt, they're not defaulting on the United States, because it's not the United States that loaned them all these dollars. It's other entities outside the United States that loaned them all these U.S. dollars. So if they default on all these dollars, they're defaulting on themselves. And when you default, then money contracts. And so a lot of their liabilities would disappear, but a lot of their assets would disappear as well. And that causes a crisis. So it's just, and this is my point, is that if de-dollarization, which so far we've had a lot of headlines and not much action, if we ever actually got a lot of action as far as de-dollarization, that would mean there's less dollars circulating out there in the system. Well, if less dollars are circulating, then it's going to be harder to service all those U.S. dollar debts. And the likelihood of defaults and a credit crisis increases. It doesn't increase. And so I've said this many times, and I hope people kind of start to figure this out, is that the process of de-dollarization is not a negative catalyst for the price of the dollar. The process of de-dollarization, because of the lack of liquidity it would cause the U.S. dollar to spike. It would cause the whole system to implode. And then after that, maybe there's a new system. And maybe that's when everybody totally de-dollarizes and there's some new currency that's used. But that successful de-dollarization will see the dollar spike before it goes away. And some people think that that's what we saw last year. I don't think so. I think we're going to have more of that in the future.
So I want to put some pull that together, tighten that up a bit. So we did in one of our episodes, we kind of dug into a little bit on the euro dollar system, and we put out a clip just on that. So if you're on our YouTube page, you can look for the YouTube cover that says "Stuck with the Buck," and that's all about the euro dollar. And I'll try to put it in the notes, something like that. But if the idea that you just said, where they're not defaulting on us, they're defaulting on themselves, that has everything to do with the euro dollar system and entities and financial institutions outside of the U.S. purview creating dollar-based credit. Now, the other point that you're making that I think is worth highlighting here is because if these foreign entities, these foreign actors wanted to really stick it to the U.S. and the U.S. dollar and just default on all these U.S. dollar loans, yes, that would create certainly an issue for the U.S. dollar, but they'd also have to go through tremendous amounts of pain because their assets would get wiped out. No one would lend to them in the open market. So it's a very nasty game of chicken that, you know, where you're driving head on into each other, because certainly that would be a strategy. But do any of these world leaders have the guts, you know, are they really that motivated to de-dollarize that they're willing to pull their kill switch, which ultimately what you're talking about in terms of, like, if you default on a loan, because all money is credit. So if a loan is defaulted and it gets wiped out and written off or written down, then that money is destroyed. And that means it increases in scarcity. And so everyone else's debt now becomes that much harder to service, which is really all, again, parts and features of the dollar milkshake theory.
Yeah.
So when all of that's going on, I think what people misunderstand is that's, you know, it's do these foreign actors, again, who have so much power, their lives, can they be any more really glorious? I mean, they're winners of the lottery politically, financially. Are they that, like, jaded about the U.S. dollar and the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency that they're willing to risk all of their power, all of their financial influence simply to de-dollarize? And I think that's kind of part of the thing that people don't realize, is that in order to get to this end of the dollar scenario, even if it's self-motivated and people are just walking away from the dollar, there's going to be so much pain involved in that for everybody. And, yes, and that really, this goes back to something you keep talking about, which is the U.S. is not going to be who ends up, and the US dollar is not what defaults first. So all of these other entities are going to go through massive, massive crises. And look, it's really easy for someone from the ivory tower to be like, this is what we're going to do. We're going to default on all these dollar loans. But then you have all the constituents and citizens are going to go completely mental over this because now their assets are going to be wiped out and they're not going to be able to get food, water, none of it. So it's also some of these oligarchs, you know, your Putins and your Xis and all these royal family types, you know, suddenly their lives become at risk when you make a big, bold decision like that. So I think people need to keep that in mind when we're talking about some of these chess pieces, because it's not as simple. I think we sit behind our screens and we live in these false sense of realities and don't realize how big the game is that we're talking about being played here. So with that also in mind, going back to kind of the hint I made earlier about, spies and this, you know, the, how funny the spy movies are about the villains, even both sides of the story, the good and evil, how everything is just so well planned out and executed. We're seeing this liquidity flow out of commercial banks, regional banks, chasing yield. It's going into money market funds. That money is then being invested in the Fed. So it's almost like the Fed is now sucking in all of this capital and this liquidity. They just announced this FedNow platform, which a lot of people are arguing is the early infrastructure to then roll out CBDC, central bank digital currency. And so we were kind of talking before, like, are they the supervillain that they're so well articulated and they're so well planned that they have this master plan to suck in all the liquidity and be the one big bank that finally gets to issue credit because all the regional banks are dead and they're sitting on this digital infrastructure and now they can control the entire financial system?
Well, it's I'm not quite willing to go that far, but I don't totally say no to it either. And what I mean by that is, I think people know that if anybody's ever heard me talk about the euro dollar, one of the other persons that talks about the euro dollar a lot is Jeff Snyder. And I love Jeff, and he's one of my favorite people. And he knows more about the euro dollar system than I ever will. But one area where Jeff and I disagree a little bit is he thinks that they are just totally winging it. They have no idea what they're doing, and they're just kind of clueless. I don't think that's the case. I think that they're arrogant, and I think they will end up screwing it up, but I think they will screw it up due to their arrogance, not due to their stupidity. I think that they do know what they're doing, or at least I don't think that they're stupid, and I don't think that they're clueless. And I think with this whole regional bank thing, I think that they know that it's going towards fewer, bigger banks as opposed to all these small regional banks. I don't know that they're purposefully trying to kill the regional banks, but I think they understand that that's probably going to happen, and I think that they're probably okay with it.
So with that in mind, what do you see? So what's funny about some of that kind of context is, and one of the reasons I always enjoy speaking with you, is there's a grounded nature to the view. And one of the things we keep seeing around all of this is everyone thinks they know the finish line. But in your take, over the next 6 to 12 to 18 months, where do you think Fed policy goes as far as interest rates, knowing that all the things you're talking about, both domestically in the U.S. and as far as, you know, the pain that's being created internationally and therefore creating all these narratives? I know you don't have a crystal ball, and this isn't something that we never really do on the show, but I think it'll be fun, given all the moving pieces that are going on, that we wrap up with a little bit of a forecast from you.
Well, to be honest, my whole story hasn't really changed a whole lot, John. I came into this year saying that, you know, sometime in Q2, there would be some kind of whether it was a crisis or whether it was just a market pullback or whatever it was. I thought that, you know, the highs for the year were kind of already in it. And I kind of feel like that. Whether we're going to have a huge pullback, in the next couple of months, or if it's going to be in the second half of the year, I don't know. But my guess is that in the very short term, the Fed will continue to tighten. I think when we get into the second half of the year, the market may force them to turn.
There it is. You know you've got a good view on things when you can drop the mic in 30 seconds on where you see things going. So you're going to be overseas for a little bit longer. When will we have you back in the Caribbean islands?
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunately in this job, you never really get a vacation. At best, you get a working vacation. So I've been in Spain for the last week with my wife, doing stuff with her in the morning and then working in the evenings. And now for the next week, I'm in Switzerland. I'm attending a conference and I've got meetings with clients. And so this is going to be a work week. But, I love Switzerland, so I'm going to enjoy this week. And then I get home Friday, April 14th. And, I guess we'll record again next time and at home base.
Sounds good, man. Well, you enjoy yourself over there. Don't eat too much chocolate. And as always, we appreciate you coming on. So everybody, if you're unfamiliar with the show's website, we do encourage you to go check that out. There's information there. I'm going to start developing a library of Brent's other pieces. So if you don't even know what the Dollar Milkshake Theory is, we're going to start putting some of those videos up there. You can find all that at milkshakespod.com. You can find us online at Twitter and at YouTube with the username or handle milkshakespod. And Brent and I are both on Twitter. I'll put our Twitter handles above us here. And until next time, Brent, be well, travel safe, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, peace, guys.